And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
This is the Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
That is hammered! Oh my!
Man, that ball got out of here in a hurry. You know, anything travels that far ought to have a damn stewardess on it, don't you think?
High drive! Left field!
This is a simple game. You throw the ball, you hit the ball, you catch the ball. You got it?
You're listening to The Roundtable with Grant Brisby, Andy McCullough, and Mark Carrig on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to episode 13 of The Roundtable. I am Grant Brisby. I'm here with Andy McCullough and Mark Carrig. And last week, we bemoaned the lack of exciting baseball stories, at least the kind of dumb baseball stories that wet our whistle. And this week, there are some silly baseball stories. Our whistle is wet. Hi, guys. How you doing? Andy, let's start with you. How are you doing?
My beak is soaked.
Beak is soaked. Mark, are you ready to talk about silly baseball doings and transpirings?
I'll tell you what's soaked. The Field of Truist ballpark. After Freddie Freeman passed through.
Oh, no.
3 days.
Oh, man. Oh, coming in hot, coming in hot. All right, but
I just want to thank both of you guys for both being here this week. 2 weeks in a row, your Ripken-esque streak of showing up to work is really impressive. Now let's go.
Oh, let's talk about cadence. Anyway, it'll be a 2-1.
All right. Settle down, gentlemen. Settle down, gentlemen. We have to talk. If we're going to talk about some beef, we've got beef to talk about. We've got Angels and Mariners, and baseball fights are generally silly things where gentlemen in pajamas push each other around. And occasionally you'll get the Donnybrook where you have some punches thrown and scraps happen. But I believe that Phil Nevin has broken new ground on the baseball fight paradigm. Mark, do you want to talk about Phil Nevin's contributions to the base brawl industry?
Phil Nevin should get some kind of Sabre award for innovation because he tapped an opener before the game, right? Unannounced opener, who, by the way, totally understood the assignment.
Oh, yeah.
And went out there and drilled some guys because that was his job on that particular day. So, we were talking about like last week, it was kind of a grind this time of the year. And then this weekend was just a reminder of how much I love this stupid game. And watching the Mariners and the Angels do what they were doing and watching Phil Nevin do it in such an innovative and artful way. I was just like, man, I love this shit. I really do. I'm so entertained by it. And by the way, before people get all bent out of shape, dude, I am not advocating like people getting hurt, right? I don't think I'm thinking of this way if people actually got hurt. But man, that was hilarious. What a thing to do. To not only make it clear that we're out here to go hit some people, but in the manner in which it was done, it was like an added middle finger to the whole thing. It was just wonderful, brilliant, innovative, whatever you want to call it. That dude should win an award.
The best baseball fights are when two kind of bad teams fight because it's like nothing's really at stake here. Like we just kind of want to fight. And like we've, you know, normally you see fights like this in like August, right? Like, you know, that's where it's like, I'm just sick of this. There's just, the season's too long. Like I'm tired of this. This, to see it in June, I mean, this, we're breaking new ground here. It's uncharted territory.
Dude, it's politics, baby. That's what it is. It's politics. What we're watching is that real politic, as they call it, because, you know, Phil Nevin is an interim manager. The best player on the planet and on his team got pissed off the night before at having a ball thrown at his head. And so a fellow who likes to keep his job, what do? You make a big show of letting everybody know You do not mess with our guy. And it doesn't matter what the score and situation were. Like, they clearly were not out there headhunting Mike Trout in that situation. But politically, you better have an answer, baby. And he did. And not only was it an answer, it was innovative. The opener. I can't get over it. Ah, so good.
At the risk of getting too wonky and getting into the weeds, I just want to know, the reasoning is the pitching coach comes out to talk to the Mariners pitcher when Mike Trout is up. And then they go back, and then there's one way up on Trout, and then one up and in. And Nevin's contention is that, well, the pitching coach came out, and then these two pitches happened. You connect the dots. And that doesn't track to me, because to me, as a baseball dummy, it just could be the pitching coach coming out and saying, hey, make sure you get it up to Trout, and you got a guy who's not exactly Mariano Rivera out there. I don't know. Like, we can go back to the dumbness in the opener and stuff like that, but does that track with you guys as baseball lifers?
Looking at it for someone who doesn't care about either of these teams, yeah, they probably threw at him on purpose. You know, why? I don't know. I mean, it's a long season. I think what upset the Mariners, obviously, is that the Angels had their shot in the first inning. They threw at Julio Rodriguez, the fellow Wants, what's his name? Yeah, anyway, the opener, the hired gun. He threw it Rodriguez and he missed, and then they opened the second inning and he's throwing at Winker. So, like, from Winker's perspective, he's like, all right, like, let's go. And there were so many great moments. I mean, any, like, Raisel Iglesias throwing the sunflower seeds is like some of the most enjoyable 10 seconds of video you can ever consume. It made me feel so good every time I watched it, and I probably watched it 50 times over the weekend.
I liked his gum toss even better because it was left-armed and the gum sailed, buddy. It just went out there and it spilled all over. If I remember correctly, his tantrum was because he didn't do anything and he got tossed.
Right. He got run, yeah.
That's a great reaction to, I didn't do anything. Well, now I'm going to do something. What can I do? What's near me? What can I? I love that. That's classic.
Anthony Rendon with a cast on his right hand mushed Jesse Winker with his left. Somehow Scott Service like ended up at the bottom of the pile just getting wailed on. You know, it was great. Like Mike Trout ran in and just immediately pulled out Justin Upton. It was a great one. I mean, there were so many great subplots.
Oh, Andy, it looked like a classic run-in, didn't it? Just a beautiful classic run-in. Like, you know who got the business? Ryan Tepera.
Yes.
Holy yeah, moly.
Just getting worked over.
By Winker. Like, dude, like that, you want to talk about exit velo? Like, Winker barreled up Ryan Tepera at the bottom of that pile.
And did you see the swing that Tepera got in to precipitate all that? Did not get his money's worth. It was...
No. They were...
it was underwater.
Both Tepera and J.P. Crawford were throwing sort of like the clubbing forearm move, which is generally used in pro wrestling because it theoretically looks like it hurts, but it really doesn't. Winker was getting in like short arm shots that, you know, the more Japanese style, the strong style, where you lay it in real stiff. I mean, it was a good one.
Oh, he did. Multiple. Like, he had him on the ground, and those were connecting.
Oh, I have a serious question, though. I understand why Nevin did this. I think this makes him look bad to ownership, right? Which was, like, clearly his audience. Or maybe his audience was his clubhouse. I don't know.
I think the audience was the clubhouse. I do. And, like, okay, so some context, right? Like, Phil Nevin is about as old school as it gets. So, you know, and I know there's, like, this romanticism about that. And so I love watching this from the perspective of, okay, finally, all these people that are like, I just wish that guy was old school. You just saw it. Now, what do you think? What do you think? Because, like, he clearly ordered the opener. God, I love this move. like, this is your assignment, sir. Go do it. And the kid freaking did it. All right? Like, he went and did it. He's clearly trying to score points with an underachieving team. He's doing it after his best player, you know, got angry the night before. Like, and it's classic. That's classic. And, like, you know, Sam Blum does a nice job covering the Angels for us, had a story about Phil Nevin's first managerial assignment. It was the Orange County Flyers in Fullerton, California, about 15 minutes from Angel Stadium. And guess what? Nevin's got a bit in there where he had gotten all these players that he played with back in the day with the Angels who were kind of at the tail end that just wanted to be on a team. I think it was Scott Spezio, if memory serves properly. And one day the team wasn't very good. He goes to Spezio and is like, watch this. And like, you know, Nevin does like the classic what you'd see out of the movie. Like, I think he turns the spread over, loses his mind or whatever. He gets done and like he's, you know, red and all pissed off and looks at Spezio and goes, hey, how was that? So this is his mindset, okay? He thinks that this is how people respond. Now, I covered Phil. 2018, Yankees. He's a third base coach. I went to school in Reno, Nevada. Phil Nevin's, I think, first like, or the where he managed before going to be a coach in the majors was AAA Reno. I knew someone that was around that club. And the first thing he did when he realized that I was covering Phil was like, you watch, he's going to lose it one day. He's going to lose it. Because that's all he did down here was lose his mind. Sure enough, I can't remember who it was. He was like on as a first baseman, ended up with the Twins and the Giants. He gets smoked. It's Red Sox, Yankees. They end up on the field. And Phil Nevin is on the field screaming at Cora, at Alex Cora, like threatening to kick his ass. And by the way, right, and Andy's question is, how does this look to ownership? You know, Phil Nevin, if you ask people around the sport, like he's the guy in the dugout that's always saying something to the players. And happened again on Sunday, it looked like. Anyhow, you know, this is the track record is my point. Tyler Austin was the name, by the way. That's who I was talking. Like, he got smoked and Nevin loses it. And he was thrown out like 9 times in a season in Reno or something. Like, I mean, it was crazy. And by the way, he gets a 10-game rip right now. What's he managed? 19 games? Like, suspended for like a third of his managerial career in the majors because he's a red ass. So like, and all of this is like not surprising because it is all on the record. This is what he is. So that, I guess, is my question sort of off of Andy's point. If the audience's ownership, does that look good? I'm not sure that it does. If the ownership's the clubhouse, does that look good? Maybe, because, you know, it's a different audience. But like, really, what I'm curious about is like all the, oh man, I love the old school. Wish people were more old school. How'd that look?
Well, it looked awesome. But, you know, it's unsustainable, right? You can't have this every night. Unless you're the 2015 Royals. But yeah, it's unsustainable.
Is there a devil's advocate argument to make that the Angels have tried the Joe Maddon way? They've had a manager who is maybe amenable to, I don't know, goat yoga or whatever the heck he's supposed to be in these days. And now it's time for someone who's got the ass. Now it's time, you've got these stars. And now, is there an argument to make if you are Artie Moreno and you're thinking like, well, we've tried everything, let's try the ass?
Yeah, because Mike Socha was, you know, famously laissez-faire for 20
That's
years.
Fair.
I mean, I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying. Yeah, the only thing we know how to do in terms of managers is just flip the switch, you know, one way or the other. You know, it's like players manager, you know, hard ass, players manager, hard ass, analytics, old school, you know. Yeah, I mean, sure. Like, we'll see. Maybe they'll go on like a Phillies-like run, you know, that they got after they fired Girardi and win like 10 in a row. I take doubt, but, you know, who knows?
12 suspensions. 12 suspensions, including an interpreter. An interpreter got suspended, an assistant pitching coach. Anthony Rendon will serve his 5-game suspension when he comes off the injured list, but he's also prohibited from sitting on the bench for the next 7 games. I guess he has to stand. Like, there are...
he has to stand.
Just, no, he's going to be tired at the end. But, like, 12 suspensions. I can't remember more suspensions than that. Is this a memory record for you guys?
The best fight I ever covered was Royals-White Sox in 2015 when it started with Yordano Ventura barking at Adam Eaton and sprawled into Lorenzo Cain and Jeff Samardzija settling up like a 2-year beef. Cain emerged with his jersey pulled over his head, which briefly inspired a meme where he was Cain-holio, like Cornholio. but that only got like, that was like 5 suspensions maybe, and it was like 1 or 2 games. I don't know if I've ever seen a manager suspended for 10.
No, that's a lot.
I've never seen that. Like,
that's
said,
a message.
Innovative.
That's the message.
Innovative.
Yes, innovative. That, I mean, Scott Service called him out on it in the postgame. All right? Like, he just, and I think anyone who's paying even a little bit of attention, you see what the hell was going on. Like, I mean, that is doubling down. So I think that 10-game suspension is obviously a reflection that the league thought that, yes, the manager intentionally used an opener to throw at some dudes, all right? And also, frankly, I think it's, hey, word's out around the league. Like I said, Phil Nevin is someone who's known as being a pretty temperamental guy. I was hearing from people in baseball on Sunday saying things like, oh, shocker, right? Like, I mean, he's been screaming at our players like all year long or whatever. Like, it's just something that happened. So I think the 10 games is definitely a message of, okay, you've had your old school, enough. I mean, that's really what sets this apart to me, the pre-planned, clearly pre-planned nature of it. All right. It was like, you know, beanball one. If it were court, right? Like, this was premeditated. Yeah, all right. So you're going to throw the book at the guy, especially when he's someone who has a reputation of being pretty excitable. All right. I don't even think that's necessarily bad, but I mean, I get it from the league perspective of nailing him for 10 games. Like, you keep, as Andy said, it's not sustainable. You can't keep going to that well. And you certainly can't use an opener to get guys hit. Oh my God. Amazing.
I wrote a story a couple years ago about the day Doc Ellis decided he was just going to hit every guy on the Cincinnati Reds.
Oh, so
which
good.
Is like one of the great moments in baseball history where Doc was just like, yeah, I don't like these guys. I'm going to hit every single one of them. And he had been planning it for months. Like, for months. I forget which. I think it was Kurt Bavacqua. He told him in spring training. He was like, yeah, I bet you a Chateaubriand, a steak, that I'm going to hit every single red in one of the games this year. And he was like, oh, okay, sounds like a good bet, a free steak for me. And then he just did it. Like that.
Five guys.
We need to bring him. But we need to bring back that sort of energy. Maybe not that exact plan. I don't know if that's the great idea, considering how hard the ball was thrown now and how out of control guys are. But I love it. I love it.
How far do you think a modern pitcher could get today? Like, how many batters? You think like two batters and then everyone's like, oh, wait a second. And then three, he's gone.
I honestly think it depends on the like the reputation of the pitcher. Right. So if it was like the equivalent of like AJ Burnett or something like that. Right. Like they could come out, you know, like Blake Snell hit Bryce Harper and broke his finger. Right. And no one was like, man, Blake Snell was headhunted. It's like, no, like Blake just often doesn't know where the ball's going. But if like Max Scherzer came out and hit five guys in a row, like I don't think he would have made it to number four. I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe if you hit, I think it's when you if you hit three guys and load the bases. And then when you hit another guy in four pitches, you're out, I would say. I think you get three.
Dude, Doc got to five or six and like pretty easily too. Like, I mean,
yeah,
and
let me look it up.
One of my favorite parts of that story is Doc, I guess, is coming off the field and he tells Bavacqua, medium rare. He likes to steak medium rare.
Yeah.
Oh my God. There's a line in that story too I remember. He's like, Doc Ellis is sick of the Cincinnati Reds' shit. Period. New graph. Like, perfect. Like, that's exactly. I mean, he was just mad about them beating his team all the time.
Oh yeah, I just wrote that. Wow, what a crazy website.
Yeah, right. Was that a line? Did I get it?
Yeah, in the spring of 1974, Doc Ellis decided he was sick of the Cincinnati Reds' shit. Wow,
there
we
it
just
is.
Printed that.
What a crazy
sight.
A time, baby.
What a sight.
So yeah,
man, don't tell the New York Times about this story. Oh my God.
You're violating like nine policies.
Manny Sanguin said, if you did this today, you'd be suspended for life. Even the catcher would be suspended. And the manager.
That's great.
Doc Ellis didn't get suspended. Oh my gosh. They were just like, hey, yeah, you know.
Different time.
Different times, man.
That was just old school. Because back then it was an unwritten rule that if you were sick of someone's shit, you'd hit him. You know, you had a right to react to being sick of someone's shit. Now, do you think that we're going to see an opener again for this purpose? Do you think 10 games is enough? Is there going to be an enterprising manager who finds that this creativity is just perfectly suited for his needs?
No.
Yeah. I think that's it. This is one and done.
Go to whatever they call Pac Bell Park these days and ask Gabe Kapler if he'd ever considered this. And see, like, I don't think most managers are really thinking about plans like this.
I could be totally wrong. I cannot remember a case quite like this. That was my first reaction when I saw it. I was like, holy smokes. Like, this was like You know, he had worked a rule or worked this, like, cute little thing to get the job done because, of course, like, who comes in? The pitcher who's supposed to throw the game, right? Like, so I can't remember another scenario like it. That's why I guess I'm, like, reacting this way. And then obviously the league thought so, too, because, yeah, 10 games, that's a pretty damn strong message to never do this again.
Did you see that once found Winker after the scrum was done? And you could read his lips and he said, "I had to." And Winker says, "You had to?
I had to."
You know, yep. And he's like, "I had to." I mean, that's a no-win situation for once. There's a lot of reasons to think that this stuff is silly, just Cro-Magnon baseball. I get that. But poor once, like, he doesn't deserve to be on our lips right now. He's just some dude trying to make it.
I'd also like to point out just essential work from the folks at John Boy Media on this video. I mean, they obviously, you know, they've built an empire and they do a really good job on a lot of different things. But this is like what they were put, what Jimmy was put on this earth to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I saw Jimmy's setup. I wrote about him once. Like, that dude, man, like, it's pretty impressive. So when he says it took 15 hours... like he said that, I think, on the video, 15 hours. He's got access to all these crazy feeds and stuff. So I don't know. It's a much appreciated effort, John Boy, if you hear this, because and if you haven't seen the breakdown, it is well worth your time. I mean, he really does. Yeah. A to Z. Yeah, it was awesome.
There was an old guy getting dragged. Old guy getting dragged. That was perhaps the thing that I would never have noticed. I was appreciative of having the old guy getting dragged.
Yeah, I think it was like, it was a Dom Chidi who just had like, he had like a kind of, he had a double leg and he was just getting, you know, he was like getting riding time, you know, after the takedown. Yeah.
I like the Shohei Ohtani ISO.
Yeah.
In that video.
Yeah.
Right? Like Ohtani just like, I don't want anything.
Ipe finds him and is like, no.
He had his entourage like holding him back. It was wonderful.
We'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. You don't get that many opportunities to upgrade your organization through a terrific hire. LinkedIn Jobs helps you to nail those chances. We've all searched for a job at some point in our lives, and chances are, if you're like me, you've used LinkedIn as a resource to network and follow the trends in your industry. You've spent a lot of time on LinkedIn, so why wouldn't you make that the place to post your job? LinkedIn isn't just a job board. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to a perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. On LinkedIn, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Hire professionals like a professional on LinkedIn. LinkedIn knows that small businesses are wearing so many hats and might not have the time or resources to hire. LinkedIn is constantly finding ways to make that process easier. They even just launched a feature that helps you write job descriptions, making the process even easier and quicker. 2.5 million small businesses use LinkedIn for hiring. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/MLB show. That's linkedin.com/MLB show to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
Let's move on to one of the other best parts of the weekend, which was Freddie Freeman's return to Atlanta. I believe that caught your attention, Andy. Andy, would you like to start with Freeman's return?
One of the most impressive hitting displays I've ever seen. This man just like on the verge of tears, apparently the whole time, going 6-for-14 with a go-ahead double in the finale against one of the best teams in baseball. I mean, just a remarkable hitting performance at a time when he was just have you ever seen a player more emotionally distraught on a baseball field while playing baseball outside of maybe Wilmer Flores?
That's the only comp, and Wilmer had reason to be sad.
I mean, he just appeared to be breaking down. Just a wild scene.
Dude, before the game even started. I mean, this is happening at the pregame presser. Okay? Like, I've never seen anything quite like it. I felt bad for the grounds crew. I mean, it felt like every time Freddie went to hit, they had to pull the tarp. It's just so much. Like, one day I get. But, like, it was almost like a three-day farewell or homecoming or whatever. And it was just like, uncle.
I'm starting to think he wanted to stay with Atlanta.
That's the kind of thing I'm picking up on, too. That he might have regretted the decision. You know who also picked up on that?
Yeah.
Your boy.
A large left-hander picked up on it.
Yeah.
As quoted in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. I mean, I think... You know, what Kershaw said was, you know, fairly, like, I would say charitable but pointed. You know, basically, like, I get it. I understand why he's, you know, it's an emotional weekend for him. Hopefully we're not second fiddle, as he put it. And, you know, this is a special team, you know, and hopefully he starts to feel more comfortable. And I think, like, you know, look, like, as human beings, we can sort of reconcile. We can understand, like, okay, what Freeman was going through was an emotional situation. He obviously did not want to leave Atlanta. He wanted to finish his career with the Braves. However, this winter, right, he had a choice. He could be an Atlanta Brave, or he could take a five-year contract. Or a six-year contract, excuse me. And he chose 6 years. And that the Braves did not offer that, right? The Braves did not make him an offer that fit his contractual terms at the time of negotiating. And they pivoted to Matt Olson when they could not find a price. They pivoted, you know, kind of shockingly, it seemed like. I mean, based on everything we've seen, right, like Freeman seemed to think it was just going to get worked out. And the Braves had more leverage, and they used it. And it's understandable that Freeman is upset about that. And I think it's understandable the Dodgers are kind of like, all right, man, like let's okay, we're paying you a lot of money, and like you're really good, and we're the best team in the National League. Like, can you stop crying? I mean, I don't know. You sort of like feel bad for the guy, but it's also like, hey, you're a grown up, you know? Like, if you want to play for the Braves, take their 5-year offer and take below market value. That's kind of how free agency works, right? The team doesn't have to offer you what you want.
Let's look at the term free agency. He had the agency, he had the freedom to do what he wanted. So, like, okay. I get it, man. He had deep connections there. I don't question that. I thought, if anything, like when it comes to just his obvious love for the organization and history there, obviously it's authentic. No, I'm not trying to be like that cynic who's laughing at it in that way, because I'm not. But at the end of the day, he was a free agent. He had the agency to choose. That's the right you have. And at the end of the day, it was his choice. So I think that's what I have a hard time with. And if I were in a Dodger uniform, I too would just be like, I hope we're not second fiddle. Clayton Kershaw, I tweeted this, right? Like, when Clayton Kershaw says something like that, I think you need to take into account the messenger. You need to take into account his history. This is a guy who, he knows what his words mean. And I think he's going to choose them carefully and pointedly, which he did. I mean, he dotted that, right? If he was throwing a baseball, that's on the black. Like, as we've seen him do for years. So, you know, message received, obviously. I was entertained by it because I thought it was kind of dead on. And I thought it was, hey, you know what? If there's a way to handle this and make it clearly not cool, but also not blow the guy up, there it was. Because as you said, it was pointed, not devastating. And that's what it needed to be.
He got the message across, but it was also like, you know, he's not like ripping the guy per se, but more just like, it's sort of, you know, hey, wake up, dude. Like, you play for the Dodgers now. And the thing about free agency, right? Like, this happens with iconic sort of players all the time, where their contract ends, the team wants to keep them, right? But it doesn't make sense in terms of them making the most money. Right. So, like, for example, like Derek Jeter at the end of his deal, and I believe 2010 or was it 2011? Maybe 2011, right? Had a really ugly negotiation with the Yankees because the Yankees made him a 3-year offer that was worth more than basically what his value was. But Jeter, you know, felt like his value was more than that. And at some point, you know, Brian Cashman said to him, like, go find a better offer. Go for it. We'll be here, you know, and Jeter took the Yankees offer, and he finished his career as a Yankee. There was some hard feelings, but it seems like at this point they're probably sort of over it. Maybe not. I don't know. Who could say? I mean, maybe not. Maybe not. Clayton Kershaw has been a free agent twice now, and both times has taken below market deals to stay with the Dodgers. I don't think anyone's like, you know, complaining about what his salary's been. He's been very well compensated over the years, but like he's faced that choice and has pivoted and said, okay, I want to stay with the Dodgers. You know, I'll take 3 years. I think it was 93 after 2018, when I'm sure he could have gotten more money on the market, right? And Freeman wanted both. He wanted the market rate and he wanted it from Atlanta. Atlanta chose not to give him the market rate and he has to deal with it. It's like the monkey's paw finger curls, right? Like I want a 6-year contract with a World Series champion. It's like, I can make that happen.
the Jeter thing you mentioned, it flashed into my mind. That was the week, like it got real nasty. There was like a tennis match in the press, you know, like there was like leaked offers and numbers were coming out and like it was getting real nasty. And one of the papers, I can't remember which of the tabloids did this, but they photoshopped Jeter on 29 other uniforms, and the back page was him in the Red Sox uniform.
Mm.
I was like, wow, that's some good newspaper.
Wow, right, that's
there. Like, man, that was just like, wow.
That's just good newspapering right there.
It was.
I'm such a human middle bowl of porridge that like I'm always, when I see a story like this, I'm always, well, what's the other side? What's Freddie? I understand Kershaw being upset, but like, why is Freeman so emotional? And I try and get in his head about, there's a difference between getting drafted out of high school and being with one organization until you're like a 30-year-old man. And there's just got to be so much emotions. And so I'm trying to imagine, trying to put myself in that perspective. But if there's one person who knows what that's like, it's Kershaw. And that's why that just, it meant so much coming from him. It's, I get this, buddy. Like, I get this. I can put myself in your shoes. I've won a World Series with the team that drafted me as a teenager. At the same time, we're kind of cool here. Like, you know, the Dodgers have a little bit going on, and I don't know. Do you think he's been aloof? Like, was there something that's precipitated this over the last couple months in the clubhouse? I know that the Dodgers clubhouse is a little bit, you know, a little bit buttoned up, right?
They're drifting towards 25 guys, 25 cabs. But, you know, I mean, that's sort of what happens when – you know, you have a lot of superstars, you know, some of them brought in from other places. But I, like, look, at the end of the day, it's not really affecting his work. He's still really good, right? He's still having a very good season. He's still doing exactly what the Dodgers, you know, have paid him to do. You know, I think it will end up being not a big deal. Like, as I sort of tweeted this the other day, like, if anything, it's a sign of his professionalism at a time when he's, like, breaking down at the sight of Mark Bowman from MLB.com, which, like, whom amongst us hasn't seen Bo and just burst into tears? Like, he's still such a good hitter. Like, he's still such a good baseball player.
He had to have such, like, the chemicals his brain was producing in that moment. If you could bottle that, that would be wild stuff, because he was just in such a zone, and it had to be just neurons firing that he hadn't accessed before that were helping him go into the elevated plane.
You know, I burst into tears seeing Bowman. It's when he was putting.
Oh my gosh. Man. That is a deep cut. Who's the best writer golfer? I'm the shittiest. You're talking to him right now. So who's the best?
Well, Mark's not a writer anymore.
That's true. among the professional class, Mark, who's the best of your peers?
Oh, man, I don't know. I don't think anybody's any good, honestly. Now that I think about it, we all suck. So no,
that's right,
but no, I gave it. I'm kidding. I did not burst it at Bowman's. But no, actually, I did anyway.
All right, let's move on to our final topic, which is the season of Aaron Judge, where Aaron Judge is having a monster season. The Yankees, they are doing okay by their own rights. And Andy, you thought that you love this storyline. You love that Aaron Judge is a pending free agent.
It's great.
Yeah, take it over.
Aaron Judge can make whatever financial decisions he chooses, right? Like, if he had taken the Yankees' 7-year, $213.5 million contract extension, that would have been perfectly reasonable. I think, like a lot of people, I saw that number. I was like, that's pretty high. You should probably take that. But he bet on himself. He bet on the irrationality of the market. He's having an MVP caliber season. And I think it's great. It's added a layer of, you know, sort of drama to the baseball season that it wouldn't have other to this season that he wouldn't have otherwise, because every time, right, he has a big game, which is like every other day, it adds another element. Like, how much is he going to get now? Is Steve Cohen watching this? Like, is he flipped over from SNY to yes? Like, would the Red Sox go after him? Blah, blah, blah. And it just adds a layer of drama that makes it so that, like, Judge is the central figure of the sport right now in a way that it's rare for that to happen. And it's because at least 5 to 10 other teams can look at him and say, that guy could be playing for my club next year. And like, they can dream on that. The Giants can dream on that. The Dodgers, the Red Sox, the Cubs. And so it's so rare that the sport actually has a main character that's not just baseball writers telling you it's Mike Trout or Shohei Ohtani, but like, it's actually someone who is relevant and not just on like a, you know, highlight screen. And I think it's like really, really great. I think it's just fascinating. Yeah. I mean, I just think it's good for the sport.
I'll tell you what's compelling about it is that it's happening on a stage like New York with a Yankees team that might be at its best for all. This is a really good baseball team. And as Andy said, Aaron Judge has made himself into the clear-cut central figure of that story. And given the stakes, personally, given the pressure that he's under every day, not just from that standpoint, but also from the team side of it, it is compelling. It is fun to watch. He's a highly skilled hitter. He always has been. You look at Aaron Judge, he's this enormous guy. And it's very easy to just make assumptions about what kind of player he is. And yet, playing a pretty good center field when he's been out there, okay? I mean, it's ridiculous. But you look at, he's enormous. He's a tight end playing center field He's Gronk, but playing center on an above average level and a great hitter.
Is he bigger than Anthony Munoz? I'm going to go look this up.
When Munoz played, I would bet that Aaron Judge is bigger than Anthony Munoz. Yes. And like, what he's doing on basis is remarkable.
Okay, Judge is 6'7", 282. Anthony Munoz was 6'6", 278. That's insane. He's playing center field.
And what, Munoz is playing tackle?
He's like one of the greatest left tackles of all time.
Yeah. But like all those 49er offensive lines in the 80s were the same size. Like, right? Like the Cowboys had those monsters, but the Niners were like, you know, smaller dudes relatively. Of course, they were chop blocking. But anyway.
Yeah. He's not bigger than Willie Ruff. If he was the size of Walter Jones out there, that would be something. But anyway.
Look at these pulls.
The first time I ever saw Aaron Judge was when my second daughter was born. I took my oldest daughter to a Stanford game, and we drove down. It was just to get her out of the house, and I didn't know anything about players on either team, and all I saw was this ball go 420, 430 feet, and from my vantage point, which was far away, to watch Aaron Judge round the bases with the perspective of the people around him, I said, holy crap, who is that? And then I started looking him up, and I started going, okay, well, wait a second. His number is 35 because his favorite player is Rich Aurelia. Like, he is, he's from Fresno. How do the Giants not jump on this guy? And they didn't. He was a draft crush a long time ago. But just watching him from 300 feet away around the bases was a transformative experience. Dude's big.
You know, watch the at-bats. Right. I mean, obviously this guy's got power, you know, he's massive and whatever, but like, just watch the at bats from a baseball hitting standpoint. Just like knowing what's coming, anticipation, covering the zone, discipline, his eye, all of it. It's ridiculous. So like, it's, you've got this like savant like hitter in this tight end Anthony Munoz Gronkowski body, you know, that can run like a gazelle in center, or at least cover as much ground as well.
Settle down. He's a perfectly fine center fielder. He's not.
Well,
he's
given what he is.
Podcast favorite Lorenzo Cain.
Dude, how many Low Cain references in a row can we make on the podcast?
Don't test him.
The Lorenzo Cain references will continue until morale.
Until morale improves. One up low. So that's three straight.
I will say this. You know, like, the bet Judge has made, right, is that someone's going to be crazy enough to give him $300 million, I think.
I think he's right.
God, I hope it's the Phillies. I'm just kidding.
I mean, so, I don't know. I was trying to figure out how to write this as a column, but maybe it's just too stupid a thought flesh out. So let's work it out here, and maybe in 2 weeks I'll recycle it. Let's workshop it. Okay. I think the team that will have the most bearing on whether or not Aaron Judge gets $300 million is the Atlanta Braves. And here's why. If the Atlanta Braves run down the New York Mets and win the National League East, Steve Cohen is going to spend $1 billion in free agency. Maybe not a billion. However, if Atlanta, and they're five games back, you can argue on a true talent basis, they're about the same as the Mets. Maybe the Mets are a little bit better. I've thought at the beginning of the year the Braves were better, but the Mets are obviously a good club. Two very good teams, right? The Mets have five games. Atlanta could run them down. If they do that, Cohen is going to do some wild things, I think. And one of them would be signing Aaron Judge.
Oh, man, that's a great call. Because not only is he loaded, which everybody knows, but he's still on that period where, you know, like that would be his third year owning the club. Like, that's when dudes get aggressive. Like, if you're like, when owners get crazy, when it's like it's still fresh. And then if the scenario you're talking about plays out where they've had this fun, good, solid baseball team and all this, and they still fall short, mm-hmm. oh, mm-hmm. baby, look mm-hmm. out. Yep, mm-hmm. I'm with you. That's a good call.
I am in my own little bubble, but I will offer up.
I wonder where you've got Aaron Judge going next year, Grant.
I will offer up the idea that the Giants had a lot of money to spend this last offseason, where they had just, compared to the pre-pandemic budgets, they had maybe $100 million to spend, and they didn't spend it. They said, no, we're going to be clever. Trust us. If the Giants, with that trust, give... limp into the last wild card spot, or maybe even don't make the expanded postseason, there is going to be pressure from maybe above the front office to say, let's get a local kid who grew up a Giants fan. This will be someone we can put on a billboard. This makes sense. I don't care about 2028. Let's do something for right now. I could see that. I really could.
Well, it's important to frame this too. Like, when you think about Aaron Judge, when you think about any elite free agent, right? Don't think about what the GM running the team thinks. Think about how the owner behaves. So, and oftentimes they're aligned, right? Like John Middleton hires Dave Dombrowski. They're probably simpatico on things, right? But like, Andrew Friedman is not a person who has ever gone out there and said, you know what I think are great are decade-long contracts for 30-year-old free agents. The Dodgers have made significant financial commitments to players because – Mark Walter, the owner, has authorized them, you know? And so you got to look at, like, the ownership groups. Like, who are the owners who really want to make a splash? I think the Giants are really, really fascinating because obviously they've got a good thing going, right? They were great last year. This year has been a bit of a struggle, but they're still, like, in contention. They're still a good club. The infrastructure's there, you know, in Farhan we trust, all that sort of stuff. But at some point, if you're the Giants, right, you've got all this money sitting around. If you own the Giants, you've got this money sitting around. You have this huge revenue source at the ballpark that isn't as full as it used to be. And you might be tired of looking up at getting outspent by the Dodgers and Padres every year. And you might want to throw the money at that.
Yeah, but first they've got to improve, like, the scoreboard and walk-up music. Boy, that is, man. You know, you're not attracting anyone if you can't get that going. Is Bags okay?
You got to talk to Bags. I'm worried about him.
Me too. I read that column like, Bags. Like,
he's fired up.
He was. Well, you know what? I mean, it is a team that's a little bit, you know, stuck in, yeah, I bet I could throw a football over these mountains. Like, they're a little bit stuck in the past, a little bit stale, perhaps. Listen, that column resonated.
They won 107 games last year.
It resonated. I'm telling you, that column resonated. It's just...
I will never understand the San Francisco market. I will never get it. Anyway.
Well, I mean, they could just bring the crazy crab back. That's all it needs, a little crazy crab.
Mark, can the Yankees afford to let Aaron Judge go?
Hell no.
Okay, well, there's another one.
They absolutely cannot. Like, look at that division. You lose a guy like Aaron Judge, and you look at he's a transformational player for them right now. Like, there's being good and looking at war and, like, seeing what he's doing on the field. What he does there is bigger than that. He fills, like, a massive role in that room. He fills a massive role in that franchise, all right? So, no, they cannot afford to lose him.
What if they were to let him go, but to placate Yankees fans, they signed Joey Gallo to a huge contract? Would that satisfy the Yankees fans?
Oh, like, man, that's amazing. Oh, what a thought. That's even better than Phil Nevin sending an opener out there to drill some Mariners.
No,
oh, man.
Refresh my memory. Who's the last guy the Yankees let go that was they wanted and then we couldn't keep him? Is there a historical analog?
I would say Justin Verlander, that deadline. When they could have gotten him, and like they would say, "Oh, we can't afford it," or like the ownership that won't let us let it happen, whatever. And it ended up being, I thought, a big deal. So I mean, but I can't, not one that jumps out to me like as far as you.
They were fine letting Cano walk at the price he got. I mean, because Cano is the closest analog to Judge.
Oh, right.
Like, homegrown superstar. You know, turned down a sort of. The deal that they offered Cano compared to the deal that they, like, before the season, compared to the deal they offered Judge, like, Judge, you could have taken this and said, you would have said, like, yeah, that's about right. Whereas if Cano had taken what, I think it was like 7-120.
Yeah, it was just for show. That was clearly for show.
Anyway, it was definitely below market what Cano got offered. And then when he got to the market, they were hard at 7-175. He ended up getting 10-240. And the Yankees were like, enjoy, you know, the Pacific Northwest. They have, you know, when they want a player, they will set records to acquire him. They paid the most ever for a reliever with Chapman. They paid the most ever for a pitcher with Cole. They will spend when they decide that we must have this player. I think it's going to be really interesting to see how they value him. Like, they put a number on him that, again, as I've said like five times on this, but it's worthwhile. They put a number on him that most people who I've talked to around the game looked at and said, yeah, sounds about right. Now, what has he done this year to suggest that he's worth more than that in a sort of like game-changing way? Not just like going from, you know, 7-213 to 7-230, 7-235, 7-250, but is there a way to get it to 8, 9, 10 years? Has he done anything this year to suggest that 10 years would make sense? No, because it would never make sense. You can't make him younger. You can't make him smaller. You can't change his injury history. But it does create pressure, external pressure, to how can you let the MVP go? How can you let this guy go? And that is going to be a really interesting stress test for the Yankees.
There's been like a cultural shift that has been underway with them for like 10 years, right? Where they went from everything's gut, pay the man, just go get the players, right? And now it's, you know, they're looking at, you know, there's a reason that that contract offer was so well targeted, okay? Like, they've got a really strong infrastructure. They have firm belief in what they do with it. I think that's what separates them. You could argue there's a lot of clubs that might execute it better, but, man, like, they are all in with the way that they think. Like, lockstep, top to bottom. So it is a stress test because, like, this is the exact opposite of what they want, right? The external pressure that you're talking about is basically, here's this guy who looks, acts, plays like an MVP, looks, acts, plays like a guy who's really important to your clubhouse and what you're trying to do. But the numbers, injury history, age, all of that, they paint a different picture. And yeah, stress test is exactly what it is. And it is fascinating.
And you can argue, maybe this is what they want. Maybe they want an MVP season from Aaron Judge so that someone offers him 3 years, or excuse me, 3 years. The classic Andrew Friedman, you know, 3 years, $300 million short-term deal. Someone offers him 10 years, you know, 325, you know, like what Corey Seager got. And you can look at that and say, like, all right, that's crazy. Like, that's crazy. I can't do that. And you have an out. Whereas if, you know, is sort of in the situation it was with Cano. 10 years, 240, we view him at 7-175. Which would you, if you look at the life of Cano's contract, 7-175 would have been a lot better than 10-240. You know, based, and there's other stuff that's happened, obviously, with their steroids and stuff. But I'm not saying that that's what the Yankees think. Who knows? But that's an outcome that maybe they're okay with. Maybe they're okay with, like, trusting in the system over individual players. I don't know.
I think the age component is what pushes that.
That's okay, a huge part.
That's a big one. Like, it's just a totally different discussion because of where he is age-wise. So, like, yeah, I think that is definitely a reasonable thought given that reality.
J. Joey Gallo's only 28. All right. This has been episode 13 of the Roundtable. We will be back next Wednesday, and we'll hopefully this week is as good and bountiful with baseball doings and transpirings as last week. We will see you then. Thanks for listening.